maybe the first question is, yeah, where are you from and how did you end up on Prince Edward Island?
Okay. I'm from New York City. Mm-hmm. And Carla is from the Montreal area. Her family moved around. Her parents were teachers, so they taught in lots of little communities around Montreal. And although they have a family home in Laurentian, so I'll let Carla tell you about that if you need it. But how I ended up, well, we met in 1969 in Montreal. I came up, I was very upset with the Vietnam War and Nixon and all of that. And although I had a student deferment, so the draft wasn't an issue right then, was not an immediate issue for me. So anyway, a buddy and I were anxious to get out of the States. We went to Atlantic City Rock Festival first, and then we were waiting for Woodstock, mm-hmm. which was in August of 69. But we still had about 3 or 4 weeks before Woodstock and just wanted to get out of the States. So we drove straight up to the border, New York-Quebec border, crossed over 1,000 islands, and flipped the coin, basically, left to Toronto and right to Montreal. Back in 69, you're probably not old enough to know this, but in 69 you could go to any town, and if there was a college or university, somebody would, you know, find you a sofa to crash on and give you a little bit of food. And so we didn't know anything about Montreal, but we got off the Bonaventure Expressway, and that led to University Avenue. Followed that, which led to McGill. And sure enough, within 20 minutes, we had a place to stay that night. And the next morning, we saw the mountain, and climbed the mountain just behind Montreal. And that's where I met Carla.
Okay.
So then, I had a couple more years of university to left. And she came down to the States for a couple of years. I was going to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And we were involved in a theater film group and moved to Colorado after university and then Los Angeles. And that's what did Carla in for the United States, was L.A.
Oh, yeah.
So we moved back to the family home in Laurentians, and this would have been in 73. And then her father, during that year and a half we were there, her father bought a farm. He was a teacher in Quebec, and he hated the Quebec government because he's Anglophone. And so he bought a farm in PEI. He'd always had a thing about PEI being a pleasant little place, sight unseen. And he didn't know anything about farming, and I grew up in New York City, and I didn't know anything about farming. So Carla and I moved to his farm in Hopefield, PEI.
We read a book called Grow It.
And that's how we got started.
That was our knowledge base. And also, we had worked on my uncle's farm for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an adventure, and we didn't actually know what we were going to do. So
you moved to PEI, to Hopefield, to the farm in 1973?
Yes. Okay. Well, he bought the farm then in 73. So we moved to Quebec, left L.A. in 73. He bought the farm in the spring of 74, and we actually moved there the following spring of 75 is when we had to move to Hopefield.
Okay.
And we arrived with 2 horses.
Not right away.
Jan
bought the horses.
Oh, it was a little later.
Yeah. Carla was, at that point, she was probably about 5 or 6 months pregnant with our first child. We arrived in April, and our son was born that September.
Okay. So you mentioned the idea neither of you really knew about farming. You just got a book read it. What really was it? Was it just the adventure of going to a farm because you could go to a farm? Or?
Well, no, it was this whole back to the land thing, you know, where we thought, well, you know, we'll live back to land, and we'll grow our own food, and we'll be independent, and, you know, all that nonsense that everybody believed back then. And it was not a working farm. It hadn't been a working farm for 2 generations.
Mm-hmm.
The fields were overgrown, the barns were collapsing, the house was not really livable, and we had no money. And bit by bit, we brought it all, you know, put it back together again very slowly.
Our dog barking in the background. Yeah. Our only livestock right now.
How large was this farm that you...
It was 223 acres with the land.
But in our room,
there was very little cleared, but we ended up clearing around... Ricky's the right one. He's just gone for a second. A few acres, 40 acres maybe.
Okay. Where would this back to the land impulse have come from?
Well, really it was, for me, it was Los Angeles really, really upset me. And we moved and went back to the Laurentians where my uncle had a farm.
Mm-hmm.
And Ricky worked on my uncle's farm for a few months prior to my dad buying that farm in Prince Edward Island.
Mm-hmm.
And really, we had no idea what we were doing or where we were headed. And so it just, it seemed partly like an adventure and partly something to do.
Okay. And I guess other people are doing it at the time, so I guess...
Well, when we came and visited, and we met our neighbors. Like, there were people, actually, who stayed in that house the winter before we moved into it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole group of people that we really liked when we met them.
Mm-hmm.
And it formed the backbone of the community. There were many of the people, PEI was interesting back then, I guess you discovered this, that there were quite a few back to the lander types, along with old-time island farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And where we live, Hopefield and Iris, two little communities, was very much like that. There were, gosh, I don't know, maybe a dozen different back to the lander types, and maybe a dozen or so old farmers.
And the old farmers were wonderful. They were they were thrilled to have people coming and working. Ricky was really appreciated because he was a good worker and did the hay and all of that. And potatoes. And so we worked as workers on the local farms nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And they lent us equipment. You know, a lot of why we were able to survive it all was because our neighbors were very generous, both with equipment and leaving us alone on the one hand, but encouragement on the other.
I'm sure they found us very entertaining. There's one story I remember, which I remember fondly, that all of the ladies in our group, as our members of, you know, were having babies, and people just, in our group, just nursed their child right there. It wasn't a big deal at all. You know, we're all sitting around the table, and the babies would be hanging right on their breast. And I can still remember an old farmer that many of us guys had helped with his potato harvest, and he came over to pay us. And you just know that he walked in and he didn't say anything. You know, he was happy to pay us and all that, but you just know he went back to his wife and said, "You wouldn't believe what those crazy hippies were doing," you know, that kind of thing. So he was a wonderful, all the old farmers that we met were just really terrific people. But the farm community in Hopefield, the old farmers, what they respected was a good day's work, a hard day's work. If you worked hard, they thought what you looked might have been a little crazy, but they didn't mind. It was, and I found, because again, we lived in Colorado and LA and North Carolina, the people here were as open and as warm as anywhere. You know, as long as you put in a day's work, that's what they cared most about.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely were different, and they definitely found us entertaining, for sure. You know, we learned by our mistakes. We did, the first few years we were farming, we did all kinds of crazy things that, you know, and didn't work out, and the old timers would tell us how to do it better, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Were you close to any local family in particular?
Yes, absolutely. Carla particularly, so I love her.
Well, our next door neighbors, who weren't farmers but just lived down the hill from us, helped us survive the first year. Without them, we wouldn't have, because we were way too cold.
We didn't know about getting firewood a year ahead. That kind of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, we ended up living just in the kitchen in a two-story house, but, you know, the upstairs was, water would freeze. And so we went down to our next-door neighbors a great deal for tea. They would invite us.
Right.
So they'd feed us, and we'd get warm, and we'd watch TV, and then we'd go home. So, yeah, our next-door neighbors on a daily basis were really made the difference. And then, like I said, some of the local farmers partly hired Ricky. You know, it was Ricky who was, I was having that first baby and then the next one. Yeah.
But also, one of the local old-timers was Angus McLean, who you probably know of.
Of course, yeah.
And he lived in, you know, down the way in Lewis, which wasn't far from us, and of course there were all kinds of active landers up there as well. And we were all friends, we all knew each other, so it was all one big community.
Mm-hmm.
And so that first winter we were so cold, we needed to get like a carry-all kind of thing for our baby. Mm-hmm. And so we went, they had sheep, Angus and his wife,
Gwen,
had sheep, of course. So we went there, and they gave us wool to make, so Carla could make the little carry-all thing for our first one. And Angus would go to a lot of the parties, you know, and he was just, he found us all. I think he was glad to see that the population was, you know, everybody was worried about PEI population slipping away, and they, I think they were all glad to see some younger people coming back.
Did you get to know him well at all, or?
Yes, I did, only because later on, I had been originally trained in film and television work, and I later on went back to that, working here at the CBC in Charlottetown. And, of course, Angus, at the time that we first met him, he wasn't Springer. He was still in Ottawa. But he came back to lead the Progressive Conservatives and became premier for a while. And then he retired from that, and by then I was in CBC, so we were doing stories fairly regularly. You know, we would be talking to Angus, so I got to know him through that primarily. But I did see him at all the parties. This was not all the parties, but at least once a year he'd be at some big function.
Yeah.
He'd stay for a while.
Yeah, he'd stay for a while, have a bottle of beer, and then go on.
Now, one thing I just thought of was that amongst the group of people that lived in Iris and Melville and that area, many were university graduates.
Mm-hmm.
We were, and a lot were. You know, people who'd gone to university and then just didn't really know where they were headed and headed back to the land.
Right. So were you yourself had been going in Montreal?
Well, I had gone to Trent University in Ontario.
Okay.
And Ricky was at the University of North Carolina. And
mm-hmm.
But just about all of the people in our community, right, were university graduates.
Right.
That's what I can't think of anybody who wasn't. Right.
Yeah, and this community, when you talk of it, I'm just picturing Hopefield, because that's where you stayed, right? Did you?
Yeah, that's where Pat Gins is from. That's when we first met. Pat was there.
Oh, which Pat was that?
Pat Gins.
Oh, okay, yeah. I got a little blip on the phone when you said that. So you met Pat Gins through all that?
Yeah, we met Pat Gins there, and he was at one of our friend's weddings. That's when I first remember meeting him, actually.
Yeah.
Was he,
He had a farm himself.
Yeah.
And he'd come by a different route, but he definitely...
Well, he wasn't a member of the community in that.
No.
He was one of these, you know, long-haired back to the landers.
Right. Yeah. He was married to a local islander.
Yeah. And he had a government job.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is before he went to Ottawa.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What were?
This was before he was in government at all. Yeah.
No, he had a government job.
Yeah, but he
ran the Access PEI.
But he wasn't a member of parliament.
No. Yeah. First, it was Angus McLean that got Pat into provincial politics.
Yeah.
during Angus's era, as you know, that Renaissance.
Yeah.
World Renaissance, and Pat was one of the people he convinced to get involved.
This community, though, you stayed. Did you stay in the same farmhouse or farmland that you first moved into, or did you move around?
I stayed there for many years.
We lived there for 25 years or so.
Okay.
From 75 when we moved there until 1998 we moved to Montague. We still own the farmland, the land, but so we moved into Montague in 98.
Okay.
Up to 20 years.
And did you know any Back to the Landers before you moved to Prince Edward Island?
Well, yeah, kind of. In University of North Carolina, it was a similar community around Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's surrounded by rural North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Chapel Hill itself is sort of an oasis of modern thought, but it's surrounded by just rural farms, and a lot of us back then, you know, would hang out in the land. We were all interested in Back to the Landers, and so there were many in that group of friends, university friends, who had houses out in the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
So we were interested in it, didn't know anything about it, though.
Yeah. So it wasn't really until Prince Edward Island that you really get to learn firsthand?
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. We did that year and a half we were in Quebec. We were on Carter's uncle's farm, and I helped out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I learned, but of course I had never even heard of Prince Edward Island until about a year before I moved here. You know,
right.
Moved here. Didn't even know it existed.
And
I can still remember when we were in Colorado, and we lived in Colorado Springs, it's just a city, but I remember somebody trying to explain to me the difference between hay and straw. I had no idea that there was a difference.
Yeah.
So, and that was only a couple years before I moved here. So yeah, I was pretty unknowledgeable moving here.
One of the things I'm really curious about is this sense of community on Prince Edward Island, and you're mentioning there's the people in your immediate vicinity, and then Lewis, and I got to talk to Seth Popjoy. He was in that Lewis area.
Oh, yeah, you know Seth very well. Yeah,
the Culloden Road and all that.
That's right.
That's near where you guys live?
Not far. I mean, it's on the other side of where Angus, you know, Angus is kind of in between us.
Right.
On the Lewis Road. But yeah, our groups would, it was like one big extended community.
Mm-hmm.
At certain, like Thanksgiving in particular, I remember for many years, everybody would get together. That side, you know, down around South area, which we call the Melville area,
mm-hmm.
and our area, which we call the Iris area. We'd all get together for huge Thanksgiving feasts. And so it was like one extended community that had smaller, literal cells, depending on where you live. Yeah.
Okay, so in day-to-day life, it might be divided up a bit, but
yeah.
That's right. Day-to-day, divided up.
Yeah, we were the Hopefield Iris group.
Yeah.
And
stuff, they were the Melville.
Yeah, they were the Melville Culloden group.
So what did community entail? You mentioned, you know, celebration of major events like Thanksgiving. You'd get together and, you know, enjoy each other's company. But what else was there to living in the community?
The only other thing I can think of for a couple of years, it was what we used to call Monday night class that I used to drive all the way to Melville for. And it wasn't anything too structured. It was just fun. I'm not even sure it was on a Monday. I used to call it Monday night because there was the farm in Tennessee. That's what they called themselves. They had Monday night. It might have been on a Monday night. I don't remember. But, you know, we'd just get together and people would talk about their lives and how they got to where they were at that point. And any other... I don't think there was that. I can't remember any other kind of regular get-together. Certainly... it wouldn't have been as organized as the island community with its churches and schools and things like that.
Right.
It would have been very
informal.
One guy had a Jack Miller, who you may have heard of in your research. He was from a ways, from the Montreal area too, but he bought a lobster license and became a lobster fisherman for a few years. And every year at the end of the lobster season, he had his big lobster party. and that drew people from all over.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, it was an endless amount of beer and lobster, and they would just fill up a 45-gallon barrel with water and have the lobster boiling in that, and it just drew people from all over the place.
How would you have earned a living while you're on Prince Edward Island? That's always an interesting story, it seems.
Good question.
I worked for the local farmers, you know, the established farmers, helping them with their potato harvest. For cash, I would help them with their potato harvest. For hay for my own animals, indeed, I would help them with hay, and then they would lend me their equipment and help me with my hay. I did that for a few years.
Now, we did have parental support from my father, who had bought the farm originally, and it was a dream of his for us to live there. He wasn't about to live there, but he really wanted to see it work for us, so we did have support from my dad.
Okay. He never moved to PEI. He stayed in the Montreal area.
Mm.
But it didn't take us too long to realize we weren't going to make a living from the farm.
Right.
We tried, though. We got involved with the lending authority and built a pig barn.
Mm-hmm.
And Ricky, besides everything else, is Jewish. So we kind of enjoyed the idea of a New York Jew having a pig farm. So that kind of entertained us.
And I wasn't the only one. There's another fellow down the road who's Toronto, from Toronto, and he's Jewish, and he had pigs as well. And you know, we kind of laughed about that.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You
yeah.
probably heard of him, Stan Sandler. He now has honeybees.
For a while I was trying to make a living from the farm on a commercial basis. We had some cows and then shipped the cream from the cows and we had the pigs. And that pretty well just covered its expenses, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was basically, there was no real living to be made other than covering its own expenses. We had chickens and, go down the neighborhood and sell the eggs from the chickens. But everything was very small time.
Yeah.
And then Carla, at a certain point, decided she wanted to get her education degree. So she went to UPEI for a year to get her PED so she could teach.
Hey, what was your education background? Because you went to Trent. What did you major in?
French.
Okay.
Yeah. Which was very useful. Boy, I didn't know how useful that was going to be.
How extensive was this farm? You mentioned you kept pigs and some other animals. I'm just curious in general numbers.
That's right. Well, let's see. We had a little bit of everything at the start.
Mm-hmm.
We had one cow to start with. She only had three teeth. And we had two goats, which grew to, I think, 10 goats at one point. We had geese and ducks, a couple of crazy ducks, and chickens. And we started with two gilts and grew one to be a sow, and we ate the other one.
Okay.
No sheep. Something we didn't have. And then Carla's mother had these two young horses up in Quebec that they trucked down to us, so we ended up with these two horses. From the one cow, and I really found I enjoyed milking cows,
mm-hmm.
and it was easy enough at that point to get cream quota,
mm-hmm.
and didn't have to pay for it, or just a small amount, but I think we were milking at that point then. We went to four cows, so shipping the cream from four cows.
With a hand separator.
Yeah, a little hand separator. We bolted to the floor inside our house. And the goat population grew. The geese didn't work out, so we got rid of the geese. The ducks kept attacking me in the barn. We finally got rid of the ducks. Drake would keep attacking me. It's a typical thing where we had all these different animals just to see what we really enjoyed and what we didn't enjoy, because we didn't know anything about any of it to start with.
Right. So, yeah, you mentioned two crazy ducks. They're crazy because they used to attack you when you're around?
Partly that. They were Muscovy ducks. They kind of didn't quack. They go, make a funny noise.
Weird noise, and the drake would chase after me. He thought I was after his duck, whatever the duck was called. He chased after me. I found that entertaining at first, but it became a real nuisance.
But our pig barn that we ended up building, I think, had 350.
Well, yeah, it got to the point where we moved there. We moved in 75 and started with the one cow and the two gilts and the ducks and the geese. And we built the pig barn in 79. And that was big enough to hold around 200 hogs at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant we shipped about 500 hogs a year.
So you for a long time to a bit of a larger scale there.
We tried to make it.
Try to make it a growing concern.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and from the one cow we went to four, and then by the end of doing it, I was up to maybe milking eight. I can't remember exactly. I think it was around eight cows.
Mm-hmm.
Chipping the cream from around eight cows. And you know, developed the land was all grown over, like it hadn't been farmed in two generations, and so slowly clearing the fields for pasture and for hay.
It was fun. I mean, it was hard work, but it was exciting.
I wouldn't trade, I wouldn't trade those years, even now, for anything.
Really, what is it, what's the essence of this? So why, what is it about being back to the land? You're saying it's exciting and it was kind of fun, even though it was hard work. What's so attractive about it?
Well, in my mind, I guess I would have to say, and of course I'm looking back now, that it was honest in that, you know, what you put into it, you could see results of your labor. Now, granted, the economy, North American economy, is based on cheap food, so you couldn't see a bank account for it,
mm-hmm.
for sure. But if you cleared the field, you know, and really worked hard, and it was hard work to get the fields cleared, you would have a clear field that you could feel proud about, you know, or build a barn, or a herd of cattle that you started with one three-teated cow and ended up with 10 real milk cows. You know, you could see something, and it felt honest. It's not, I don't know, I mean, I haven't changed my opinion that much in that. For me, anyway, having worked now, I was at CBC for around 18 years, and at the end, there was nothing good to show for it, really. I had a bank account, but I couldn't really see much for all my labor. On the other hand, Carla was the teacher. That's a whole different story. But I guess I'd have to answer that the key word for me was that it was honest work.
Mm-hmm.
I felt honest about it. I totally didn't know what I was getting into, for sure.
Right.
But I feel good about those years anyway.
When was it you became involved with the CBC? Would this be the radio or the television?
It was TV. Well, what happened was because people, our neighbors and our friends, all knew my story. And I lived in L.A. and trained in film and theater and TV. And that was, you know, a big thing for me. I still really loved it, but in L.A., Carla had enough with the States and with that whole world, and I was given a choice. It was going to be either her or she was going to go, and it was really up to me to decide if I was going to become another L.A. type or if I was going to do something different. But I never lost my, you know, real love of camera work. So anyway, everybody kind of knew that story. But I didn't do anything with it from 75 until 1985. I just farmed for 10 years. That's all I did. And then Jack McAndrew opened up an independent video company in Charlottetown. And it just so happens that our friend and neighbor, his younger brother, who was a whiz on electronics, got a job with him on helping set up all the electronics.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just said to me, well, Rick, you should go in and tell them you do camera work, you know. And I said, nobody can't walk in off the street. But I guess I kind of chewed on it for about 6 months or so. And finally, one day I did. I just walked in off the street and said, if you ever need somebody to help out with camera work, I'd be interested in doing it. And sure enough, they had a job, it was all independent, it was all just contract work, one production the time. So they had something on the go, and I worked with that. And then another one, and then another one. And then they got the contract to do commercials for CBC, and that became fairly regular, like once every 2 weeks. And then once a week, it became more and more regular. And then something opened up part-time at CBC. So that's how I got back into doing camera work.
So when this happens, does this put the farm work on the back burner? Or do you still try to put that up?
Entirely. Well, it became obvious by the mid-80s that although, you know, as I was saying before, how you could have a clear field and you could feel proud about it, but it did nothing for your bank account. And our children were getting, you know, they were starting to grow up, and at that point we had three kids to raise, and I had never lost my love of camera work. So the farm went progressively more and more to the back burner, and then it became I had to choose because you really couldn't do both. I couldn't work in town and have dairy cows, for example. If I had beef cows, perhaps. But so I had to choose. So by the end of the 80s, I basically entirely stopped farming by the end of the 80s.
What is it? What made you guys decide you wanted to stay on PEI?
I still remember that it was after we'd been here for 17 years. That we realized that we had decided to live here.
Right.
You know, because we kind of didn't ever decide. We just lived our life.
Yeah.
And then at that point, we decided we do live here, and that's when we decided to buy the farm from my dad.
Okay. What really led to that decision? Because, you know, with your skills, you could go off and live somewhere else. It's not like you were, you know, unskilled people who had to, you know, stay in a certain situation, but you did end up staying there. What were the factors there? You know, what was so
The community that we developed, you know, with the people from away, and the community are also our immediate neighbors in Hopefield, and falling in love with the land, I would say. And you know, for me, Ricky mentioned teaching. I really loved living in one place because, Ricky mentioned, my family moved around a great deal.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, it was all in Quebec, but it was a lot. And living in one place and enjoying the place matters. And now, I have now taught so many kids that I know a great many parents because I got to know them through their kids.
Right.
And so it's a feeling of belonging.
For me, PEI just kind of grows on you. I was from New York, and I am still a New Yorker inside, without question about it. But yeah, I don't know. PEI just kind of grows on you. I can't describe it any better than that, really. Well, I still remember when the first morning we woke up, we were in Hopefield. We had moved there that first morning. And I absolutely felt like I'd landed on Mars. Absolutely, that's exactly how I felt. I still remember that feeling. There was nothing. The nearest house was a quarter mile away down the hill.
Right.
And there was an empty field across from us and an empty house across the road, but it was not lived in. It was an empty house. And there was our place and our fields that were growing over. And I just felt like I'd landed on Mars. Quite remarkable.
What were some of these? There must have been some major challenges here that you had to face, you know, living this brand new lifestyle. Because you mentioned coming in spring of 1975 and you had a farmhouse, but it wasn't really fit to live in. You have uncleared land. How did you go about this? You know, did you just go about fixing up the house yourself or figuring out how to do that? Or?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what happened. We went about, because we couldn't afford to get anybody to do it, so we did it. Room by room, you know, ripping the plaster off and putting insulation in between the joists and the studs, wall studs, and then putting wallboard back up. And the first winter, we could just do the kitchen and dining room area, or even just the kitchen, I think, and actually one room at a time. And we didn't know how cold we would be, again, because it was the spring of 75. So, you know, we just didn't know how tough it was going to be. The water stopped working in November of 75. The well casing and sand had gotten below it, and the well had caved in, and it just stopped working. And the ground was freezing up, and we went the winter without running water. And but then we had a cow and goats and horses in the barn, and we'd have to go that old empty house across the road. There was a hand pump behind it, a little pump shed. Mm-hmm. And we had to cross the road with buckets and 55 pumps. I still remember it took 55 pumps to fill a 5-gallon bucket of water, haul it back across, and then the cow would just scoop it up, you know, she'd drink the whole bucket in one. So it was tough. And Carla, we had a, you know, our baby was born in September, so we had a little infant. And we just didn't know how tough it was going to be. It wasn't a plan. It just, we just had to do it. There was no choice.
Mm-hmm.
So we just did it, and we were cold and worked hard.
What was it like living with the
spirit?
Yeah.
Well, the spirit of adventure, really, and of learning, you know, because we didn't know anything, so we were always learning something, and it was physical, you know, and both of us, you know, we'd had a little, theater is physical, you know, when we were involved in the theater group, there's various work, you know, like for, you know, the stage, and I'm, but this is really physical, and that was fun.
Yeah,
she found it fun. I just found it something I had to get through.
Right.
And I can still remember in March when things started to finally thaw out, and what a relief I felt. You know, it was, we made it through that first winter, and immediately started thinking about the fall. That, and to this day, that has shaped my attitude about winter.
Yeah.
You know, when it's fall approaches and all. But I don't know how to answer that question about what it, you know, felt like. To me, it wasn't a spirit of adventure. By then, it was just had to absolutely do it,
mm-hmm.
and get through the tough part and then the good part. I can still remember, though, in the spring, the grass is this beautiful, soft green. And I can remember, not that first spring afterwards, but a couple of things. We cleared up some acreage and had some cattle on it, you know, and I was plowing out back, and I looked and I could see our cattle on the field, you know. It just felt good, you know. I accomplished something that created a little good space on the earth, but it was hard to get to that point.
But the other thing is the animals. Ricky is just reminding me of the animals, because, you know, going out and milking the goats and, you know, just leaning against the goat and milking her and, you know, the smell of the animals and the nature of the animals. And so the animals were a big part.
Mm-hmm.
I guess part of what I have to say is responsible. I felt their constant responsibility, you know. Making sure the animals were looked after became a fairly large responsibility, and you know, making sure they were secure against the snow, you know, in the wintertime, the barn held up and stuff like that. That kept me going because I had to do it. I thought I had to do it.
Right. Once you start having children involved, you know, all of a sudden there's more than just the two of you that you have to take care of. Does that complicate the back-to-land lifestyle much, or does it just make it...
Yeah. Well, other people were having children, too,
mm-hmm.
and our children were definitely another connection with other people,
right.
And when you talk about the community thing, a lot of the community thing that happened on a daily basis was connecting kids with each other. Like, one of our neighbors, their kids stayed with us a lot. And so we kind of had their kids and our kids, and that was a lot, you know, a lot, pretty regular. And then other kids. So we were connected through our children with our neighbors.
And you had mentioned that it seemed most of the people, if not all, in your community had university and college degrees.
That's right, yeah.
What would it be that, you know, why would it be that this particular segment of society would be attracted to going back to the land?
I can only extrapolate from myself. Again, for me, you know, being in the New York world and growing up in New York, and the combination of back then in 69, the war in Vietnam was a big issue for me, and the nature of American society was a big issue. So I was obviously looking for something that I felt more had more sustainability, for lack of a better word. Other people, I think it was probably something similar. Obviously, my Canadian friends, you know, didn't have the Vietnam War as an issue, but probably the world at the time. I can remember going to Toronto, visiting Toronto, sometime around 69 or 70, and Washdale was a dormitory that was sort of like an alternative community.
Right.
And I had the sense that even there, you know, people were looking for something with some longer-term meaning to it.
Right.
And I want to sound spiritual or theological, because nobody really knew. You know, we had all these different ideas, and everybody had all kinds of philosophies and things at the time. And, you know, there were the Hare Krishnas and all that nonsense going on, but this is just one more possible way that people could have found, I guess, to perhaps be a little more meaningful than competing with the Joneses next door and having a better car and, you know, all that kind of crap that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a flimsy answer, I know, but I can't put my finger on it other than that.
Back to the Landers on Prince Edward Island, I know, of course, you mentioned the people in your area socialized, but did you socialize at all with members across the island in other areas? Did you have the opportunity to cross paths with them often? Or was being on, you know, your farm something that limited that?
I'd say it was pretty limited. You know, Melville area was pretty well the farthest afield that we would go, you know, in terms of other back to the Landers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for us, I don't really
know. Like, we did get involved with the Jewish community a little bit. There's an island Jewish community, which is almost exclusively mixed. That means, you know, Jewish, non-Jewish relationships.
Right.
Get together for a couple, like Passover and...
But not back then so much, Carla.
Well, that's when we started.
With Wendy Ader, but...
Yeah.
But even the Katzes were in the Melville.
Right, they didn't go.
Well, Amon and Sammy went, they sent them. But, I mean, they were in the Melville area, so they weren't very far afield either.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't getting involved with the Charlottetown, the Jewish community kind of thing until years after.
What was your first impression of Prince Edward Island when you came here? Do you have any recollection what that would have been?
Well, for me, it was landing on Mars. Carl, I don't know what...
Well, to me, it was very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have another first impression of it. It took a little longer to formulate.
Okay.
Again, coming from New York, I was very class conscious because in New York City, you would have the very poor bang up next to the very wealthy. Literally, somebody could get out of a Rolls Royce and step over a homeless person. It's not that bad now, but it certainly used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very aware of the whole class structure of society. And when I first noticed my rose-colored glasses on PEI, it struck me as a virtually, not absolutely technically, but virtually a one-class society. Yes, they were very wealthy, and yes, they were very poor. But nobody was particularly opulent about it. In other words, the wealthy families, like the Scales, for example, didn't flaunt their wealth. I saw no BMWs or Mercedes-Benzes for many years on PEI.
Right.
and very few big, wealthy houses that were still single-family dwellings. They were tucked away behind high trees and such. And the same thing with the very poor. Yeah, there were a few shacks and shanties, but not much. And most people were working hard trying to get by. And it struck me as a, you know, in relative terms to the rest of North America, very one class. And I really liked that. I absolutely liked that.
Are there any anecdotes or stories you'd like to share with me just about, you know, your time, you know, living as back to the landers? I don't know if there's...
Well, I'm going to tell you about my neighbor.
Okay.
We had a wonderful neighbor when we had lots of animals, and something we didn't mention is it took us quite a while to get fences.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ricky says he had 10 goats. He actually ended up with about 16 goats. And our goats used to go across the field to our neighbor's oat field and get into his oat field. And he used to say to me, "I believe they've eaten all the weeds."
He was a wonderful man, an absolutely wonderful, kind-hearted man. Yeah.
Was he an old farmer?
Yeah, it's funny, he grew up on a farm. He was not very interested in farming. In other words, he plowed and he milked cows, you know, and all of that. But his interest wasn't in it particularly.
Yeah.
And the last 10 or 15 years of his life, really to supplement his income, he worked at the Rhode Island Ferry.
Okay.
But his main interests were philosophy and talking, and he and Carlo would just chat about God knows what for hour on end. He just was very interested in the world, the bigger world.
Yeah.
And he himself had never had an opportunity to really observe, you know, witness it firsthand. So he was, he was very much like that. I used to get really upset when the goats would cross over to his fields, you know, and I felt like eating them, shooting them. And he was very calm about it. He said, "Well, that's okay, they're just eating the weeds."
Was there any particular reason why you didn't have the fence up, or was it just a matter of eating?
Well, with goats, you can't. All you can do with a goat, even to this day, I firmly believe, is you can fence them out of something, like out of your garden. But to try to fence them into a field is virtually, like we have page wire up and all of that, and they would just work their way through the page wire. And, you know, you try the thing with the triangular yokes around their shoulders that keep them from getting through the page wire, but eventually they would break the yoke or break the page wire. They just, it's almost impossible to fence them into something. You just have to fence them out of it. Which you really don't want, yeah, because it's a smaller area. You can fence them out of your garden. You're not trying to fence them into a, so maybe your garden's only a quarter acre or an eighth of an acre. So you can put a huge amount of effort into fencing, but if you're trying to fence them into a 10-acre field, you know, it's a lot of land to try to put a huge fencing thing.
Yeah.
It's very expensive.
True.
That was our experience with that. With even cattle, it's not like I had a long time to get the fence in, but with the cows, you know, we ran some barbed wire, and with most of the cattle, that worked. There was one cow I had the last couple of years, a Holstein. I was into Guernseys, they're a much quieter breed of cattle than Holsteins. Anyway, we had one Holstein, and she used to jump the wire. But basically, I didn't have too much trouble with the cattle.
Yeah, we had lots of trouble with fences because we had horses and goats, and neither horses nor goats
respect
were easy to fence.
Okay.